open the public hearing on HCR 5. Ask the committee administrator to introduce HCR 5.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, HCR 5 commends Elsie Scherr on completing her 95th year of life and for her continuous service to the citizens of Beaverton and the state of Oregon. She was honored in 1978 as Beaverton's first citizen, and the Beaverton Senior Center is named after her.
Anyone care to testify on this? Any comments from the committee? Not for closed public hearing, from the first session on HCR 5.
Mr. Chairman.
I'd move HCR 5 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Miller has moved HCR 5 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Brown.
Aye.
Senator Biden.
Sure.
Senator Miller.
Aye.
Senator
Schar. Aye. I receive the necessary majority. HCR 5 has moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and Senator Hartung will be carrying. We'll open the work session on HCR 9. Would you, committee administrator, tell us what HCR 9?
Mr. Chair and members, HCR 9 commends the Oregon National Guard and their commander, Major General Raymond Frederick Reeves, for their service to Oregon and to the nation.
This,
Mr. Chair, I would move the bill to the floor with a pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Brown has moved HCR 9 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none, clerk call the roll.
Senator Brown.
Aye.
Senator Bryan.
Yes.
Senator
Moore. Oh, sorry. Just waiting for the testimony that I know is going to be good.
We do have a session tonight.
Aye. Having received the necessary majority, HCR 9 is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And we don't have a carrier.
I'd be happy to do that, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Miller would be happy to carry that bill and is so designated. We're going to open a work session. Is that who we are? Is that work session or possible?
Yeah.
We're going to open a hearing on SJR, open a public hearing on SJR 7. And do we have anyone signed up?
I have a bunch of judges.
Like trouble.
Interesting enough to get three of the Supremes.
Separate the cramps a little more.
We've had a hearing on this.
Sir, is anybody here to testify on the Dash-3 Amendment?
The, Brian?
Yeah.
I believe that we're
I could explain it to you. And
what is
it?
We
wait for him to come back.
Yeah. We're going to close public hearing on SJR 7, waiting on another member who has dropped the... We have wait a minute. I'm sorry.
I suggested waiting for Senator Bryan, but perhaps if the justices wanted to comment on the Dash 3s, if they
that would be.
We need for them to come all this way.
I really would appreciate hearing their thoughts.
Okay.
They, have you gentlemen seen the Dash 3?
We'll invite you. I'll reopen the work, the public hearing on SCR 7 and invite you to explain your position on the amendments. That's three amendments to SCR 7.
All right, Mr. Chairman, if I may, I'm Wally Carson, Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court, and thank you for allowing me to testify. It had not been my intention to testify, but I've been here before. I know if you walk in the room, you're a fair target. I received your very able administrator fax, I think, over to our State Court Administrator, the Dash 3s. I saw them late that mid-afternoon. We're hearing cases this week and next week. And I have no official position to share. What I will do is we have a, my understanding is right now it would affect all appointments to Circuit Court, Tax Court, Court of Appeals, and Supreme Court, and I feel compelled, which is my practice, to ask the Executive Committee of the Judicial Conference. By statute, all state court judges are members of the Judicial Conference, and we have an executive committee, and I need to get back to them to see if they can inform me, and then I will come back either by letter or in person and tell the committee what our position is. But right now, I have none.
Appreciate that. Question, Senator Brown?
Justice Carson, would you be willing to answer a question about your personal feelings about these amendments?
That's why I brought Justice Ouellette up.
Okay.
Hope he doesn't start with Justice Carson meant to say.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, I'm dodging it now because I would prefer to give, as the Chief Administrative Head, I'm more comfortable representing what the judges group say, and we'll see where that goes. And but Justice Ouellette is here, and I'm sure
he has no qualms.
Well, that's in my experience, yes.
There's something on my forehead.
Not at all.
Senator Starr, members of the committee, I'm Mick Ouellette, an Associate Justice on the Supreme Court, and I'm from Milton Freewater. Just to clarify how far off I'm coming from. The committee has been kind enough in two other sessions to listen to my concerns about the original approach taken by SCR 7, the Dash 3 amendments. Whatever the motivation for them, I'd have to say that the Dash 3 amendments meet the objections that I voiced in terms of turning this process from one that I was concerned was going to reflect by inappropriate analogy, the federal system, into one which is a reflection of a process that's used in one way or another by an awful lot of states, and it becomes a matter in which I suppose this committee and the legislature will have to have some discussion with the governor as to how the governor feels, or at least I suppose you're curious about it. But that's about the size of it. It does remove us from the confirmation process, which, as I indicated to you before, I thought was inapposite in view of the way we have to seek office periodically in any of this. So to the extent that my comments had anything to do with the Dash 3 amendments, one, thank you for listening, and second, the Dash 3 amendments accord with my personal views with respect to a more useful way of selecting judicial nominees.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that input, and we will look forward to your response.
And I'll get it as promptly as I can.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members,
Brown.
Let me ask Justice Ouellette. It has been my experience that primarily a list goes to the governor that's been created by bar members. And given concerns or qualms about lists being created by non-bar members and folks sort of not involved in the whole.
Senator Brown, members of the committee, the choice as to where to get the commission seems to me to be a classic political choice. And the bar has done yeoman service over the years in providing input to various governors with respect to the people that they thought ought to be appointed. It may very well be that it would be useful to include members of people appointed by the president of the bar rather than the chief justice, for example, if I can raised a heretical suggestion that the boss might lose some power that way. The bar's participation in the past has been very useful. And since I know both from personal experience, having gone through the process twice myself, and having watched the process with respect to appointments to my court, there is great value in what they do. And to remove them entirely may not be as consistent with getting good input as you would wish it. One way to deal with that, of course, is to provide simply that the commission shall consist of X members and provide that they shall be appointed in a manner to be provided by law, and then you're in a position to set it up in a way which is more consonant with whatever you think is worthwhile. This too will work, but one thing I do want to point out, right now the commission that's provided for has only 5 members. If that commission is going to be responsible for vetting appointees for all the courts, that strikes me as being a close to Herculean task. And so you might want to, since your question raises the point, Senator Brown, you might want to give some thought to that.
Further questions?
Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening. I'm in the middle of your
SCR-7?
SCR-7 amendment. Testimony here. Were you able to hear any of it?
No, I wasn't, and I'd like the chair to reschedule it for Tuesday. For a couple of reasons. One, for the reasons we discussed in caucus today, for counting noses. And then secondly, the Oregon State Bar said they'd have some constructive comments to make about the makeup of the commission and how it would work. So if, with your kind indulgence, if you could wait till Tuesday, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Committee. That works for me. We will close the public hearing on SCR-7, and we will open the public hearing on SCR-41, and we have one witness signed up. Okay. Edwin Peterson.
My name is Edwin Peterson, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Edwin Peterson. I was on the Supreme Court from 1979 until 1994, and I was Chief Justice from 1983 through August of 1991. This bill is very interesting to me personally for historical reasons. Shortly after I became a judge on the Supreme Court in 1979, it occurred to me that this is an idea that ought to be explored, and I even went to the effort of actually drafting some legislation. I never talked to any legislator about it, but I wanted to see what it would look like to elect members of the appellate court in my district. At that time, I thought it should be considered, and after 15 years as a judge, I now believe that this would be poor public policy. Somebody that's much smarter than I once said that judges have no constituents. And if there's anything that's true, that's true. Judges can't have constituents. And so electing judges from a given district wouldn't create a constituency for a judge, as I see it. The judge would still be required to uphold the law according to the oath that the judge takes, and that is to support the Constitution and laws of the United States and the state of Oregon. That's the judge's responsibility. No geographical district can be favored over another geographical district. No city can be favored over another. But there are some other more practical reasons why I'm here today to speak in opposition to this legislation. Governors that I have known have taken their responsibilities to make judicial appointments very seriously. And almost without exception, the judges do that on a non-political basis, and I might say also on a non-geographical basis to a lesser extent. For example, both Governor Straub, Governor Straub appointed a law professor, and one other governor, I can't remember who it was, it was the appointment of K.J. O'Connell back in the late 50s. Then the governor decided that the court should have a true expert in the law, and therefore they appointed Hans Lindy in 1977, and K.J. O'Connell, a great jurist, back in 1959. And most of the governors, as I've said, look at what they think the court needs and make their appointment on that basis. For example, in my own case, I was a completely unknown trial lawyer from Portland in 1979 when I heard about the vacancy on the Supreme Court. And to the surprise of virtually everybody, I got the appointment from Governor Atiyah, and I later learned that the appointment was made because Governor Atiyah's first criterion was he wanted a lawyer who had extensive current experience as a trial lawyer. I hadn't even known Governor Atiyah before I was appointed in 1979. Now, currently, most of the members of the Supreme Court, in fact, I think it's true, all the members of the Supreme Court, come to the Supreme Courthouse every day to work. There are some inestimable benefits that obtain from that working elbow to elbow. I can't tell you how many hundreds of times I've gone next door to talk to another judge to talk about a proposed opinion. Or I remember one opinion I had in which Hans Lindy, who was a ferocious advocate, he and I spent the better part of a half a day walking around Salem talking about search and seizure law. I happened to win that battle, the state versus Turtle. I later lost the battle, though, when he was able to get 4 votes for his position. But the point is, I can't overestimate the importance of this collegiality. In my prepared testimony, I referred to it as consultation, cooperation, and collegiality. That creates a lot better work product when you can work with people on that basis. And from talking to some judges on the Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, there's no collegiality whatever on that court, and it's just an entirely different world. I have had some experience sort of derivatively with states that have a system in which they elect their members of the Supreme Court by district. I think that there are 6 or 7 of them. And I know that the judges, they don't talk to each other, they don't work together, not everything, but most of the work that they do is by faxes or by mail. And I don't know whether there's been a fiscal impact study on this bill yet, but I think the fiscal impact would be considerable. This bill requires that every judge must be a resident of the district in order to run for the office for a period of a year before the election, and the judge must remain a resident of that district during the time of his or her term on the Supreme Court. To me, that means there's going to be a duplication of efforts. Every judge very likely would have to have a clerk and possibly secretarial, and probably secretarial help in the judge's district. Now, I can't say that would be duplicated one for one in Salem, but I'm pretty confident in saying that there'd be a substantial duplication of effort. But getting back to the point that I made earlier, I'm convinced that the quality of the court's decisions would not be enhanced if this measure were to pass. Granted, it would give the electorate a feeling, perhaps, of having a stronger relationship to a given judge than they would otherwise have. But when you consider all of the other points that I mentioned in the balance of things, I believe that this is not enough to support the passage of this measure. I might add, I support strongly the election of judges. But I think the status quo has worked pretty well, and I suggest that we stay with the status quo.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I was just curious, who's the proponent of the bill?
Senator Nelson.
Is he going to be here to testify in favor?
Well, he's supposed to be on the way, and we're not.
Okay.
Not sure of where he is at the moment. Any further questions?
I will.
Senator Brown.
Just initially, one of my concerns about this is that my recollection is we had a bill come through fairly recently that required justice of the peace to be lawyers, and that in some counties it was a hardship to find a lawyer to be a justice of the peace, so we didn't, I think it was not mandatory. So it was optional. And so I guess my concern is, will we be able to get folks that have the kind of experience that we want to be deciding cases at that level when we do split up in 7 districts?
Well, I thought about Senator Brown and Mr. Chairman. I have thought about that, and I think I would be disingenuous to suggest that it would be impossible to find in a district consisting of 1/7 of the electors from the state a qualified person. I considered making that argument and decided not to.
Okay. Thank you.
I think from the east side of mountains, I appreciate that.
But you know, Senator Byrd, if I may say this, I'm very sensitive to the fact that a lot of the people east of the mountains feel disenfranchised because of the difficulty of electing a judge from east of the mountains. We had that the race a few years ago when Judge Gelbert from the Dalles ran against Ed Fabian during Cook. And I'll grant you that is something to weigh in balance, but all things considered, I don't think it weighs that heavily.
To your argument that having them elected from the 7 areas would argue against their being in residence or being in the office every day, would not an elected Supreme Court judge likely move his residence here during his time of service?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think not, for 2 reasons. The first, maybe 3 reasons. As I read the bill, it says the judge must be a resident of the district for a year prior to election. And if I recall correctly, there's another provision in it that says the judge must retain his or her residency during the term of the office. I don't lay my... Yes, it's on page 2, line 16. A person elected as a Supreme Court judge must remain a resident of the district during the term of office for the position. So I doubt that many would move to say that.
Appreciate that. You've made a better reading of the bill than I have. Any further questions? Senator Miller.
I would just observe that would be probably easy to cure. We wanted to do so, and there was simply, if the requirement was that you lived in the district a year prior to the election, you intended to get reelected, there's a good chance you'd go reestablish residence if you had moved to Salem for the time that you were on the bench. Again, I just put that out if that's a problem for me. And I want to ask, education, if I could. What is the current geographical composition of the court? Under their current residence?
Senator Miller and Mr. Chairman, the judges are here, they can correct me, but I believe 2 members of the court are now Salem residents, Judge Beeson and Justice Carson. I believe the other members of the court all are
supportive. Correct.
Would that be also true of the Court of Appeals, you know?
The Court of Appeals has one judge from Eugene. And I don't remember what the
are you aware of any that are east of the mountains or south of Eugene?
Walt Edmonds on the Court of Appeals. He's a senior, one of the senior judges on the Court of Appeals, senior in terms of service, is from Benton.
Benton, Mr. Chair. But Walter, I did move to Salem a number of years ago. He doesn't, I don't think he has the residence. I think someday when he retires, he intends to come back to Mr. Oregon, but
everyone.
You know, if I may say this, I never voiced this when I was Chief Justice, but from a purely work product standpoint, I've always believed that it would be desirable to have a law that required all of us members of the Supreme Court to live in Salem. Of course, that wouldn't be a very popular. But it would make more certain the benefits that I first.
It is the number of people running for the job.
Thank you. We're going to ask Senator Nelson to come up and.
Wow, this is a tough crew here.
It's going to be real bad.
Yep.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is David Nelson, State Senator from Pendleton, and I'm here to speak in support of Senate Joint Resolution 41, being from Eastern Oregon. I know that there is great discussion about how we should depoliticize the judicial process and ongoing, as part of it's going on for several years. I feel this is the way that this could be done. You have a geographical representation from various parts of the state. I know there's some always some implication that perhaps courts can be packed, that type of thing. I think if you had a geographical representation, particularly in a state like Oregon, that you would resolve that problem. I'm in support of this bill. I haven't really read it as thoroughly as I probably should have. I just like the concept that somebody from Eastern Oregon, Southern Oregon, would be represented on this court. So don't want to take any more of your time. If you have some questions on me, I'd surely be happy to answer them.
Questions?
Dave, you missed some of the discussions in terms of the ability to live.
Yeah.
In the metro, if you're on the court, it'd be pretty hard to be in Pendleton.
I heard the residential question.
But, I mean, I have great reservations and probably don't support the idea, but I'm curious. If the bill just spoke to original or residency at original election?
Yeah, I think that would be the answer. I mean, as the former Chief Justice said, the work product, coming back to Pendleton is not a viable option.
Be like being in session this year. Yeah.
And that would be the realistic part of it, is somebody would have to live in this area.
I suppose the other option you could have would be to not even stick to residency, but just have the election by the people of that district that would sort of get to that. It's not likely that someone from Pendleton would elect a Portland justice.
Senator Nelson, Justice Peterson spoke of the notion that an able jurist does not have a constituency. Mm. I'm wondering, this bill kind of implies that maybe you do, or maybe you should, or somehow you're thinking there will be maybe a little different perspective provided, I guess, from different geographic regions of this state, and you think that's appropriate?
I think that's appropriate, yeah. I think we all come to any process we're involved in with certain thoughts, biases, and our backgrounds. And I think a geographical representation is the proper way to look at that. And I understand there's some problems, but I think they can be worked out.
Any further questions?
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. Appreciate that. I'm going to close. Anyone else care to testify on SCR 41? Do you have any? Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on SCR 41 and we have, I've taken Senate Bill 704 off today's agenda. We're going to move on to House Bill 3340. And we had Representative Gianella wanted to testify on this, but now the House is in session, perhaps is unavailable. I'll invite Charles Stern, Yamhill County, to come forward as we open a public hearing. On HB 3340.
Oh, yeah. Good afternoon. Late afternoon now, isn't it?
Yes.
This bill kind of came out of a conversation, an email that I'd had with my representative and senator, which is Senator Shannon and Representative Janelle. We haven't had an issue of federal prisoners in Oregon for too many years, and under current law, the removal of the rights to vote when you're convicted of a felony only exists if you're in the custody of the Oregon Corrections Division. And so suddenly we've created a community that exists inside the city limits of Sheridan. The city limits of Sheridan has 1,662 voters. There are 3,000 people in the federal facilities inside the city of Sheridan, and we do have people registered there. Not many at the present time, and the number registered varies. And so as we chatted about this opportunity, Senator Shannon was very anxious to close a door here. whether or not they voted or not, they have an impact on the major 50 issues because they're counted in the base. And so as are the people in Oregon Corrections Division, they're counted in the base. And so these are, they're because they're registered voters. And so we were looking at being able to do something about that. The federal system under federal law provides that anytime anybody is sentenced in district court, that a notice be sent to the chief elections officer of the state from which that person is and is from, so that the federal law allows you to do something about it if the state provides for it. And we, of course, just not provided for it in the past. And so I get these notices about which I can do nothing. These are Oregon, Yamhill County residents. This one was sentenced in the District of Maine and sent back to Sheridan. But I can't do anything about it under current law. And so that this bill addresses saying that we need to remove these from the voter registration file, takes care of major 50 issues for people trying to pass levies, and it also removes the possibility of a block of voters in the city of Sheridan deciding who will be mayor.
Really a block. You could have the mayor in the cell block. Then.
Yes.
So.
Thank you very much. Anyone else? I close the public hearing, open the work session on House Bill 3340.
Mr. Chair. I assume this has been done, but Elsie has looked at this and we have no constitutional problems with this.
That,
why isn't it in his committee?
I'm glad it's here. We have enough.
This is about elections. Anyhow,
okay.
I would entertain a motion.
Chair, I move House Bill 3340 to the floor to be passed.
Senator Bryant has moved House Bill 3340 to the floor of the Duke pass. Any further discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Bryant.
Aye.
Senator Brown.
Aye.
Senator Bryant.
Aye.
Senator Miller.
Aye.
Senator Stone.
Aye. Having received the constitutional majority, we will declare House Bill 3340 moved to the floor of the Duke pass. We'll ask Senator Shannon to carry this, and if she's unwilling, we'll allow the limb.
Mr. Chair, if I were her, I would have used this to her advantage in her next election. She could have gotten well established in Sheridan won handily.
All righty.
Probably all Republicans, though.
Going to open the work session only on SBR 36. The committee administrator told us where we are with.
Mr. Chairman, the committee SBR 36 proposes a constitutional amendment that would change the number of votes from plurality to majority that a person needs to be elected to a legislative office, certain statewide offices, and United States Senators and Representatives from Oregon. We received testimony on April 13th.
This allows for a runoff at the choice of the of that individual who was defeated, but who may have lost in a very closely contested race in which no one received a majority.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I think I was the one who went to the most highly contested race of anyone here, and I'm like, you know, kind of tough to meet you if you lose, you lose. The other practical problem is that I assume in November, if you have a runoff, we'll be having runoff elections over the holidays and probably have difficulty finishing them and vote counting before the start of the legislative session. And the other reality is that the runoff could allow the person to get... You don't have to get a majority of the votes, as I understand it. You don't need as many votes as the winner got in the actual November general election. So I think I would be concerned about this one. You could get less votes in the runoff and win, but still you could get fewer votes than the winner did in the general election and then win the race.
That's true.
Also, Mr. Chair.
Senator Byron.
I think the other thing that's really a bit of a problem, and I'm recalling some of the testimony of the Secretary of State already, as we've talked about trying to meet earlier in different discussions, one of the issues is that Secretary of State now can't get the certification of the election done any sooner than, I think, December 7th or 9th, when we went through the calendar. If you had another election on that, you would be into not being able to get that person seated until probably late January, maybe mid-February, and that would leave the situation, for good or bad, I think, of the district being unrepresented for a good portion of the legislative session, as long as if the legislature continues to meet in January.
Yeah. I think, did we have testimony on particular races where this might have applied? Seems like
my notes show that they...
Mr. Chair,
yes.
The elections director, Colleen Seelock, testified that between 1980 and 1998, there were 19 times when this bill would have come into effect.
Between 80 and 98, period of which would have encompassed 9 election cycles. We had 18 times that it would have possibly, well, it would have come into effect.
I was just informed by my very able staff person that it takes 30 days for the election results to be final at Senator Beyer and for the abstract to be back, and then an additional 60 days for vote by mail to run the whole process of vote by mail. So you really would have a problem with having folks not be available for a legislative session until a month or two into the session. But if you folks want to go there, we're happy to protest along the way.
Thank you, Miller. The 60 days on the vote by mail? I'd also say the 30 days to certify the election is the time allotted, not necessarily the time required. So I imagine if they really wanted to get after it, they could, particularly if you had a close race, you could probably give this some priority. I think the thing that this bill gets at, in my mind, Mr. Chairman, is this additional third-party candidates coming to the fore. Maybe it isn't prevalent yet, but it's likely to be. And the question is, maybe the district was a bit put off under our current rules. If they wouldn't have somebody, perhaps, if the Secretary of State can get their stuff together and certify a winner, see the district more or less inconvenienced if they send somebody to the Capitol who got 34% of votes. Or would they feel better if they waited an extra week or two and sent somebody who had 50%? I guess the question is posed in this
session. Well, your question that someone who had, may have less votes than the winner did in, maybe in themselves in the general election. Because it's an off-cycle election, you wouldn't have as good a turnout. Turnouts drop off in the off-cycle elections down to about 35-40% versus the 70% in general.
That's certainly a possibility, and my sense of the things are that if it was run right on top of or right behind the general hotly contested general election, that and vote by mail, that the likely turnout is likely to be higher.
So if you had the election in January, then it might be better?
Well,
right after the holidays?
I would suggest that the ballot could be in the mail before the holidays, and that
I think you could do that.
I wasn't here for the initial testimony. How many states have a runoff provision now? I know some do. And what's been their experience?
You know, I'm not sure that question's been answered. It's a good question.
And are we only talking about the general election, not primary?
That's correct.
So that must be referenced in other parts of the Constitution that aren't on the bill.
That's very strong.
Ask Charlie. He's here. He knows.
Could you help us a little bit with the scheduling?
We did not take any testimony about other states, and I don't know.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Charles Stern, for the record, I'm a county clerk. I think one of the policy issues you have to look at is how are you going to handle the military and overseas voters? Because that's one of the things that really drives your window. And so you have to evaluate that. Currently, they go out 45 days ahead of time. So you're already starting to see where you're moving out, but you have to create a window to print the ballots after you once made the determination what race falls in to that grouping. You have to create a window to print in, and then you have to decide policy-wise how you're going to handle the military overseas voter. I think that's the horns of the dilemma that you really creates the larger window that you're talking about.
Mr. Chair? Yes. Senator Charlie, sort of roughly in terms of just physically running an election, what's kind of the window that you would say, you know, if we had a runoff, if there was one out of the general election, what's the turnaround in something like that? How quickly would you be in a position to, I guess you couldn't print the ballots or design the ballots until after you certified the election.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, the process is that once the election's over, we still receive some ballots from other counties that may have been dropped off there. There's a little window of time that we allow for that. We have that window of time in which, because there's, I think Senator Miller made references, the current law provides this window, but maybe we could shrink that. That has to be looked at carefully about how you're going to shrink that window. But we couldn't begin the ballot prep until after the Secretary of State had collected the data from the various counties and been calculated who falls into that grouping, who's going to be on the ballot. We wouldn't know that. And so
you'd pretty well know that. I mean, you'd know whether you had a legislative race that was appeared close enough. Now, I guess we're suddenly going, I think we're still in the same. If you know you got one, can you do something out of the ordinary to count it quick? Get the work done, get the Secretary of State so they can certify that. Look, realize that's still everything else off in the election, John.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I have not sat down and worked out the calendar for doing that. As I think some of you know, this session I've been working the records and marriage issues of the clerks, and I think other people have been working the elections issues, so I haven't been really working this bill heavily to know where that's at. I would have to sit down and just draw out a line of days of how that would work. How much could you compress the time that we now have for certification? How much time the Secretary of State? The issue, I think, is you want us to go off newspaper reports that this is the close race and start going with ballots, or do we actually get the count from the Secretary of State? And I think...
Don't you give the count to the Secretary of State?
Yes. But newspapers start making these statements that this is a close race and may go into recounts and all that. And I don't think that's what we want to go from. We want to get certified, finish off the job completely so that we have hard figures to work from the Secretary of State and just certify back to the counties what races would fall into that category. How much you could shrink the window, I'd have to sit down and work with my colleagues and create a timeline to do that. And if you want us to do that, we'd be happy to do that.
Senator Miller.
One thing I haven't quite understood is the vote by mail,
mm-hmm.
the effect of the vote by mail the last couple of elections, you've been prohibited, as I understand it, from counting ballots until the poll closes. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, the absentees aren't counted until the polls are closed to be sure you didn't vote both places.
Right.
But the other ballots, there are processings that begin on those as we do early pickups so that we have results that we can release at 8 o'clock.
Is that on the day of the election?
In a vote-by-mail environment, we count them on election day. And so in a vote-by-mail general, we're better prepared to be moving along. The law lets you to drop your ballot in any county of this state. And so we get faxes saying, now, we got 5 ballots we'll be sending to you from Deschutes County. We may send some to Jackson County. And so there's this window of time in which we're exchanging ballots. And so until we get that data, we don't move into the certification phase. We,
because we try to get that all together so we can count those votes. Those votes are important, too. And then how much that can be dwindled is where I'd say we'd have to sit down. And, I was not prepared to deal with that, what that narrow window could be shrunk to.
If I might, Mr. Chairman, if you had the authority to begin your count a couple of days in advance, as long as we could keep a lid on the results, wouldn't you be pretty well prepared to determine what the close rates out there and get be able to comply with the aims of this bill? I think you'd have a pretty certain result, I would think, at 8 p.m. on election night if you had 2 or 3 days to do the count.
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, I think that you can have a close feeling of where your close races are, but you don't have actual numbers by, 8, 9, 10 o'clock election night. I think that's true, even under current law.
I'm saying you might have. You'd have a pretty good impression if you had.
I think we have that now, under current law.
Okay.
We could, but that tells you who's close, and it gives you the feeling of who's close, but it doesn't give you the final actual numbers.
Sure. We had testimony from Colleen earlier regarding this bill, and part of that was testimony was that there was 18 races over 19 races over 18 years when this would come into effect. The and that's with knowledge after the fact. And I'm wondering, I guess, how many multiple candidate races there were that fell outside of this bill's intent. In other words, where one candidate did, in fact, receive a majority of the votes cast.
Chair Starr, members of the committee, for the record, I am Colin Seelock. I'm the Director of Elections. In my earlier testimony several weeks ago, we talked about 1998, there were no elections that fell into this category, meaning that every candidate elected received a majority. In 1996, to be more specific, we had 4 races that would have fallen into this runoff position, beginning with the U.S. Senator race, in which Gordon Smith was elected. But there were 7 candidates, and because there were 7 candidates, he did not receive a majority. State Senate District 2, where Gary George was elected, because there were 2 other candidates in the race, would have fallen into this position. State Rep District 24, where Richard Devlin was elected, and there were 3 other candidates for a total of 4 in that race. And State Rep District 28, where Roger Beyer was elected, because there were 2 other candidates in that race. 1994, there were 3 races. The first congressional district, when Elizabeth First was elected, and there were 3 other candidates in the race. The 5th congressional district also that year, where Jim Munn was elected, and there were 2 other candidates in the race. And State Representative District 22, where Sharon Wiley was elected, and there were 2 other candidates. Probably the race that you often hear about in this category was the 1990 gubernatorial race, where Barbara Roberts was elected, and there were 3 others. And then prior to that, the Secretary of State race in 1984, also where Barbara Roberts was elected, and there were 2 other candidates in that race. So you can look at it and see that it crosses political lines. It doesn't favor one party versus the other. Sometimes a Republican is elected, sometimes a Democrat is elected. But in 1998, the only races that would have fallen into that category happened to be a judicial race, which is not covered by this bill.
back to questions that were raised here about, is there any way to expedite the re-election if we chose to go with this resolution?
Sure, sir. I think what we would want to do is look at that very carefully. I think Charles Stern has pointed out some examples, so we've got to get all the ballots and count them. What we see is in our last general election, where many of the ballots, more than 50%, were cast absentee, that the rate of return is changing. And so that people are hanging on to those mailed ballots and aren't returning them until the last day or two before the election or the day of the election. And so it's difficult to process them ahead. I don't know of any state in the nation that allows for the counting of ballots prior to election day, but we've set progressive patterns before, and that may be one that you'll want to take a look at. The one thing I would want to emphasize, in many of these races, before you went to a runoff, you might have to conduct a recount. And so we want to make sure that you've got time in there to conduct a recount, especially if the obvious winner is very close to 50%. And they may think there was an error made that would push them into the majority instead of just plurality. So you'd have to leave time for that. My understanding from clerks and discussions on this in the past is it is very difficult to isolate a race off the ballot so that it gets counted completely ahead of everything else, that in order to certify the ballot, what you're really doing is having to count the entire ballot. It's hard to run those ballots through and say, we'll only count this race because we're in a hurry for that one, and then turn around and have to recount all the ballots for everything else. The hurdles that we would face in conducting the ballot early, I think Mr. Stern addressed accurately, which is that the U.S. Department of Justice and their concern that military and overseas voters get to participate in these kinds of elections, especially the more important elections, the federal elections in their eyes, that this, you know, they would be very concerned if we had a window to conduct an election that would not allow for ballot delivery to far military posts. So those are things we would have to look at in order to ensure that it could be done in a timely enough fashion to get all of the I's dotted and the T's crossed. And as you know, in a highly contentious race where those numbers are tight, everybody's looking to see if we have done everything properly, which, of course, we would want to ensure before we went on to that. I don't know if that's helpful, but
I think it's helpful. Any further questions?
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Brian.
Colleen, how long does a recount usually take?
Chair Starr, Senator Bryan, it usually takes, depending on the length of it, we could take 3 to 5 days to actually conduct the recount. If it's statewide, it takes us longer. If it is just a district, even if it's a congressional district, we can shave days off of that. But in a statewide race, I can specifically get you answers to that because we have now done recounts on a statewide basis.
Any further questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate you coming over and helping us understand this.
Certainly.
We are in work session, and my desire, I guess, would be not to move this bill at this time, and so we're going to close the work session on STR 36, and we're open a work session on HJMH, and it is my desire to move that bill. We've had testimony, and Senator Brown has raised some questions regarding HJM 8. I have
seen what I mean.
Any further discussion?
On HJM 8?
Yes.
I have several questions.
What are we doing? Your questions
include You want me to go through them, Mr. Chair?
Well, yes. We're in work session, and we need to...
All right.
What bill are we on?
HTM 8. Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, on page 1, line 16 through 19, the memorial says, and certainly I'm abbreviating because I don't want to take up the whole evening. I know some of you may have dinner plans since we're going to be on the floor at 6:30. It says, whereas Section 2, Article 1 of the U.S. Constitution prohibits statistical guessing. I have actually a copy of the Constitution, and I don't see any reference to statistical guessing, and I'm wondering if someone could tell me where the use of guessing is prohibited in our Constitution or in the U.S. Code or the Oregon by statute.
What is the Constitution? It just talks about national enumeration, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. So is the memorial then inaccurate on lines 16 through 19? So why isn't the actual phrase statistical method or sampling not used as it's used in the U.S. Code?
I think the eyes of many that that method might be in the nature of guessing.
Well, Mr. Chair, not according to our Constitution.
Constitution referred to actual enumeration?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But the memorial says the Constitution prohibits statistical guessing.
Well, I'm not sure that... I think that, not being a lawyer type, that to me, actual enumeration is, in fact, not guessing.
Mr. Chair, follow-up question?
Yes.
So why wasn't the phrase statistical method or sampling not used in the memorial?
Mr. Chairman, I didn't write it.
No.
I suggest that in the minds of the authors that was probably their way of describing the sampling method used is not as accurate as the actual enumeration.
Mr. Chair, follow-up?
Yes. Senator Brown.
Who, in fact, are the authors of this memorial?
That's what we found. Here's the representative, Snodgrass and Winters.
The reason I asked that question is because a very similar memorial was introduced in Minnesota. In fact, the exact same language.
I didn't do
it. Okay. Mr. Chair, some other questions about the bill?
Yes.
On page 2 of the printed bill, lines 8 to 9 express concern that using data enhanced by modern statistical methods might expose the states to attacks of litigation that create costs to taxpayers. Were there any court challenges to Oregon's 1990 redistricting plan? And did that plan have data enhanced by statistical methods? And who brought those challenges? And how much did those challenges cost the state?
An interesting bunch of questions. I don't think that we got any answers to those with us here today.
There were challenges.
Yes, there
were,
and I'm sure it cost the money.
Mm-hmm.
As there always will be.
Has anybody here read the Census Bureau's plan for the 2000 census? No. Okay. Well, their plan, their operational plan, is to count 100% of the households and housing units. So if that is in fact the case, why are we memorializing Congress on this issue?
Mr. Chair.
I'm assuming I'm not going to get answers to any of my questions.
I think you've had some answers,
Mr. Chair. Then.
Whether they're adequate or not is up in the eye of the beholder. But I'm certainly not up to answering all of your questions in detail. Senator Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's just that, frankly, I'm always somewhat critical of these back home letters to Congress. I think they're a waste of time largely. But this one strikes me, since we already have had a court case, so the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that
Census Bureau has to do a direct enumeration. It's a waste of our time and paper to even be dealing with it. The issue's already been decided. You're not going to change any decisions that are going to happen now. Congress has resolved this issue. We're only months away from them doing it. So it's a waste of time to do this, other than a feel good for somebody.
Mr. Chair, I wasn't here when this was heard. What was the purpose? Why did the sponsors want this resolution?
Mr. Chair, members, I believe that one of the issues here is the use of census data for federal races versus state races and state legislative redistricting more accurately. And page 2, lines 30 through 33 address that issue. As I understand, the U.S. Supreme Court case deals with Census Bureau figures being used for federal redistricting or federal purposes.
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding that the Supreme Court also ruled in that case the Secretary of Commerce is required, if feasible, to use statistical methods in developing the census data for all purposes except apportioning congressional districts among the federal states, which include legislative redistricting. The other piece here is the allocation of federal dollars. And it's my understanding that the U.S. Code requires its use.
Senator Miller. Senator Bryant's understanding, Representative Winters presented testimony, I thought rather impressive, that she, as a person of minority status, did not feel, I think almost felt slighted that she would be somewhat swept up in the statistical sampling and wanted to be counted, and felt that it should actually be done as to having some statistical genius who may or may not be accurate try to account for her presence and others. And so she was a very strong advocate for this memorial. And Mr. Chairman, I would move H to the floor. Would you pass recommendation?
Mr. Chair, simply because Representative Mears doesn't speak for all the African American Latino community in the state, I've received actually several documents from national organizations, but I would say that there's quite a bit of disagreement on this issue in terms of minority populations, and that Representative Winters is not really speaking for all people of color. I certainly can't presume to.
I appreciate the good representative's desire to be counted, and as I understand it, what the U.S. Supreme Court has said is that she will indeed be counted. That's not an issue here, but we have a motion on the floor. I think it's a waste of time.
We have a motion before us, and I think that not only the representative's argument, but the argument on the issue of our district are issues, and not an issue.
Well, anytime Congress is in session, they can reconsider. We wouldn't want them to.
They can't reconsider a Supreme Court order.
Well, I think they can. I think they can reconsider other aspects of using this.
Mr. Chair.
That's our decision.
I appreciate the fact that we're reconsidering. But the reason, let's be honest about the fact we're reconsidering it, and with the Republican National Committee asked state legislators to introduce this memorial, it was sent all over the state. So this was not Representative Winters' idea to come forward with this, at least according to the Republican National Committee. I mean, other folks may have other information, but that's the information that I have. So I just wanted to put that out.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just heard Representative Winters testify to. I didn't hear her say that she was here at the request of any particular organization. She was speaking as from her heart and for herself, and I thought it was persuasive. And I would also note that my motion incorporated the amendment that was made at our last meeting, so it's to pass as amended.
Be passed as amended. Further debate. Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Bryant.
Aye.
Senator
No.
Senator Byers?
No.
Senator Moore?
Aye.
Senator Scott?
Aye. Having received the necessary majority, SJR. No, 8 a.m. 8 has moved the floor with the DuPont recommendation. And I will carry that. And with that, we're going to close the Senate Rules and Elections Committee. Thank you all for attending.
Thank you.
Order. Order.